You are listening to the Professional Education Broadcast Network. Thank you for joining us for Attorney Ethics and Elder Abuse. I am pleased to introduce our speakers. Joining us from Chicago is William Freivogel. Mr. Freivogel is an independent consultant to law firms on ethics and risk management. He was a trial lawyer for 22 years and has practiced in the areas of legal ethics and legal malpractice for more than 25 years. He is a member of the editorial board of the ABA BNA Lawyers Manual on Professional Conduct and recent past chair of the ABA Business Law Section Committee on Professional Responsibility. He maintains the website Freivogel on Conflicts at www.freivogelonconflicts.com. Mr. Freivogel will serve as the leader of today's program. Joining us from McLean, Virginia is Thomas Spahn. Mr. Spahn is a partner with McGuire Woods LLP, where he has a broad practice encompassing complex commercial, business, and securities litigation. He also has a substantial practice advising businesses on issues such as properly creating and preserving the attorney-client privilege and work product protections. He is the author of the treatise, The Attorney-Client Privilege and the Work Product Doctrine, published by the Virginia Law Foundation. Joining us from Cleveland is Adam Freed. Mr. Freed is a partner at Remminger Company, LPA, where he has an extensive fiduciary litigation practice, representing beneficiaries, trustees, guardians, and other challenging estate planning documents and related conduct. A nationally recognized expert on elder abuse, he has been invited to lecture to the American Academy of Forensic Psychiatrists and the Law on Undue Influence, Claims, and Exploitation of the Elderly. Mr. Freivogel, I hand the program over to you.
Welcome, everyone. In the next hour, Tom, Adam, and I will cover the difficult topic of ethics and the discovery or suspicion of elder abuse. Adam will get started with a discussion of psychological and sociological roots of elder abuse. Tom and I will follow with a discussion of selected ethics issues, including confidentiality, joint representations, and working with clients with diminished capacity. Adam, I'll turn it over to you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you inviting me to speak about these issues along with you. We have a concept of financial exploitation I would like to begin with as being a very serious and substantial issue being faced in every state in the United States of America and probably worldwide. In America, according to the Consumer Digest study, 5 million victims on an annual basis per year of elder abuse, including financial exploitation, has been predicted. The Government Accountability Office has suggested that 14% of elderly have encountered abuse in the year 2009. The MetLife Mature Market Institute estimates exploitation involve about $2.6 billion annually on an annual basis. And if you consider the baby boomers controlling about 80% of the liquid assets, coupled with the fact that about 10,000 people per day are turning 65 and older for the next 20 years, you really can understand the nature of the problem. I think that exploitation is gaining ground as a concept because there is a significant percentage of not only problems relating to exploitation, but also because I think our lawyers and doctors and other professionals, frontline professionals, are starting to consider the issues as being real. Our role as attorneys in dealing with people who suffer from diminished capacity or otherwise susceptible to these kinds of problems is really difficult to assess. And I think one of the basic issues that we deal with here is the concept of testamentary freedom. Testamentary freedom being a very important aspect of American jurisprudence. And we take that and say, how does that butt up against the process of our role in protecting against the concept of exploitation? So it's zealous advocacy that puts us in a position where we feel the obligation to adhere to the wishes of our client, and it's the problem of detecting whether our client's wishes are actually being portrayed or whether it's the wishes of someone else that relates to the issue of our ethical obligations. So, as an example, A book titled Elder Mistreatment, which is a survey of jurisprudence across the country, Abuse, Neglect, and Exploitation by a panel to review risk and prevalence of elder abuse and neglect discusses that it is difficult for experienced professionals to distinguish unwise but legitimate financial transactions from an exploitation caused by undue influence. A great example of this is Mickey Rooney, you know, the famous American actor. He was married to his eighth wife, and the stepson, his eighth wife's son, took possession of Mickey's money and started working and handling his financial affairs and became his power of attorney. Over a period of time, he was directing financial information to himself, and he would force Mickey Rooney over time to essentially work and tell Mickey that he was broke. What you might think is generosity may in reality be exploitation and emotional blackmail. That is something that Mickey Rooney testified to before Congress on the subject of financial exploitation and elder abuse. In other words, he himself felt, as he testifies, over the course of time, my daily life became unbearable. I felt trapped, scared, used, and frustrated. But above all, I felt helpless for years. I suffered silently, unable to muster the courage to seek the help I knew I needed. If it's difficult to tell when somebody's suffering from a condition of exploitation, then you have to consider yourself as an attorney to be in a position where you may be called to task for documents that you've drafted for a client or for advice that you carried out on behalf of a client. And so, particularly with estate planning lawyers, when someone comes into your office to discuss the nature of a new will, you have to be on your toes for the circumstances of that estate planning request. Wear the hat of a litigator. How would somebody look at your work product and test it? Are there unequal disposition of assets? Are the disposition of assets unnatural? Is there a detectable mental or physical impairment? Are there changes to a longstanding estate plan? Is there an uncharacteristic gifting or retitling of assets? What are the family dynamics? Signs that that psychiatrists refer to, and I think the courts across the country look at to determine if undue influence has been perpetrated, include isolation. Perpetrators tend to try to create a siege mentality where the outside world is dangerous, where people are portrayed as evil, manipulating, and the target must seek refuge from these forces. They create circumstances of dependence where the target is in need of protection, where the power is consolidated, and the target is portrayed to himself or herself and the outside world as being weak and feeble. It creates a sense of powerlessness. And so I'll give you an example of a case I handled involving an 86-year-old lady who was suffering from moderate to severe dementia. She had lived in the home that her mother had grown up in, and her biggest fear was losing that home, and her biggest fear on top of that was going into a nursing home. That home was the most important thing to her, and through the process of a relationship with an ex-son-in-law, she gave the ex-son-in-law a power of attorney to manage her affairs. In the process of managing her affairs, he was using the funds as power of attorney and told her she was not aware of what her assets were, told her that she was running out of money and that she would have to sell the home to pay for medical care. And in that context, Louise is her name, in that context, she was convinced by her power of attorney that would be an appropriate process. Power of attorney retained counsel that had represented the power of attorney in the past and said to her, why don't we do a deal where I will purchase the home and in exchange we will prepare a lease that will give you a right to live in the house for the rest of your life. Well, those documents were prepared, but they didn't actually do what they said they would do. And as the process of execution was unfolding, This Louise said, I don't want to sell my home. and after a significant amount of back and forth, she finally agreed to sign the documents. Within 2 months after signing the documents, Louise was moved out of her home. She was put into a facility where she did not know the providers. The POA, who paid one-third the purchase price approximately for the purchase of the property, used that property and the money of the from the power of attorney to rehab the property. Over the attorney's testimony, the attorney claimed to represent Louise. Over the attorney's testimony, the transaction was set aside. And so you have to ask yourself, in the representation of a client, who was the attorney obligated to represent? What duty did the attorney have to inquire about Louise's circumstances? And exactly what role did the attorney play in being able to accomplish the goal of the client? If a transaction is being set aside after the legal work has been completed on the grounds of undue influence and or incompetence, then the attorney's role has not been adequately met. Another example, a 90-year-old gentleman named James was legally blind. His trust, over multiple versions, had always benefited his only two children. Towards his end of his 90th year, he suffered a fall and was sent into an emergency room. He was diagnosed with mild dementia and had severe hallucinations, and his doctor recommended that he be admitted to a nursing home for a couple months to do some rehab. Some acquaintances came to visit. These were younger people who were the children of James' girlfriend, and these acquaintances started to talk to James and suggest that what he was doing was being forced into a nursing home by his children, who wanted nothing more than to take possession of his property. Within several days, James was convinced to check himself out of the facility against medical advice. He had retained new counsel, changed his powers of attorney, and he had, within 30 days after that, changed his lawyers, changed his doctors, and added these friends on as joint tenants to about $300,000 to $500,000 worth of assets. And so, who did the attorney represent when he came in to have James execute a new power of attorney? Why did James, after 90 years of life, or as old as his children were in any event, why did he all of a sudden dislike and change his relationships with his family, with his attorneys, and with his doctors? What we see in the literature and what we see in case law, developing undue influence matters, developing risk for guardianship proceedings, is the question of what happens when you're dealing with a predator versus a victim. The predator offers himself as the savior, healer, or advocate, and over time the victim severs relationships with friends, business associates, and family. So if you're in the process of preparing estate planning, or you're contacted by a new client, maybe an old client, to help a friend, and your client is benefiting from the transactions, you have to remember that at most circumstances where the question of undue influence or incompetence is at play, there's questions about whether your testimonial privilege will be protected. In Ohio, for example, Revised Code Section 2317.02 provides, the testimonial privilege established under this division does not apply concerning a communication between a client who has since died and the deceased client's attorney if the communication is relevant to a dispute between parties who claim through that deceased client, regardless of whether the claims are by testate or intestate succession or by inter vivos transaction. In other words, if you are representing a client who comes in a diminished state and you are really trying to ascertain the intent of the individual you're representing, to be that zealous advocate, it's very important to take a global look at your client and understand the circumstances surrounding your client's transactions, the reasons behind those transactions, and in that fashion, you're better able to react and participate in the representation of your client in accordance with the model rules. Mr. Freevogel?
Yes.
So I think it's appropriate to hand this one back to you.
Yeah, I've got a question, actually maybe a couple of questions.
Sure.
The exception you read, as we discussed before the program started, that Ohio is somewhat unique in that it has the privilege is covered by statute. That's true in California as well. Tom, can you tell me or tell us how many states do the privilege by statute rather than common law?
I'm not sure. A good question. I'm not sure exactly the number. Most of them do it by common law or with a combination, but Ohio and California are kind of the two states that I would point to that do take a very statutorily centered approach. And I think that the general rule in the common law is would follow what Adam said as the testamentary exception, and that is that if people are claiming under a will, saying, well, this means that, the theory is that the law thinks that the decedent would want his or her lawyer to speak up. In other words, normally you've got to keep your mouth shut for the rest of eternity if your client tells you something, but the theory is that as long as they're trying to take under a will, then the decedent would want the lawyer to speak up. I think that if it's a purely, and Adam, Bill, and I talked about this too, if it was simply an allegation of undue influence, I'm not sure that would do the trick in most courts. I think in Illinois there's a case that says that just an allegation of undue influence doesn't automatically pry open the decedent's lawyer's mouth. But I understand in Ohio there was sort of a reference to that. The testamentary exception kicks in when there's a dispute about the meaning of the documents, as long as it's people taking under the will. It's very different if it's a will was never probated, although, Adam, it sounds like it's intestate in Ohio, or if a creditor is coming after the estate money, then the decedent would not want the lawyer to speak up.
Yeah, well, that's not the Ohio exception in the statute sounded an awful lot to me like the crime fraud exception. For privilege.
Yeah.
In other words, if you can make a showing to a court, for example, of a probability that there was undue influence or strong indication that there was undue influence, that might well trigger application of the crime fraud exception as well as the Ohio statutory exception.
That's a great point, Bill, because the crime fraud exception, also common law in most, maybe in all states, but it says that if you can come up with sort of a prima facie case, then the court reviews in camera the communications, whether they're oral, usually written, and then if you meet some sort of unclear standard after that, then the court lays it open for the whole world to see. And it might be very well be crimes or frauds, as Adam was explaining, and so that would be important. One thing that's significant, going back to what Adam said, is that under the crime fraud exception to the privilege, you don't have to prove the lawyer was even knew that there was a crime or fraud involved. In other words, it's not just if the communication would be evidence, the client would have to further, the communication would have to be furthered, I should back up, the crime or fraud would have to be furthered by the communication, that is, that the lawyer is being used by the client for the client's future crime or fraud, as opposed to either a past crime or the client having to prove that the lawyer was somehow involved and knew about the crime or fraud. So you could have a lawyer that's trying his or her best, like Adam was explaining, and still have this privilege stripped away.
Well, the concept of fraud in juxtaposition with the concept of undue influence are interesting. I view undue influence as a creature of fraud. It's maybe a subset of fraud, but the reliance part of it might not apply in a undue influence case when an individual comes into an attorney's office and says, "I want to disinherit my son." For reasons that make limited sense or might not in fact be true. And it's the concept of the direction that attorney's going to take and whether an attorney will be credible if they're called to the witness stand to uphold a transaction that they participated in. And so oftentimes, well, I would suggest that every lawyer maintain a file. I think that we have to be able to identify what occurred in our process. And if we don't have a file, we have a lot of problems that proceed. And, you know, having pursued dozens of will contests and trust litigation matters, the attorney is always going to be made a witness in my case if they were a participant in some form or fashion to the transactions. So what will your file demonstrate? In the case of the of Louise, who gave sold her property to the power of attorney, when we subpoenaed the attorney's file, the only phone number in the file was that of the power of attorney. There was no suggestion that there was any independent conversation with Louise. The billing records demonstrated only communications and or payments by the power of attorney. The concept of development of the lease and the terms that went into the lease that enabled the power of attorney to terminate it were discussed only with the power of attorney, and the attorney, Louise, had nothing to do with the process. When draft documents were sent, they were sent to the power of attorney, not to Louise. And in the context of James, similarly, all of the communications before meeting with the client were done with the friends. And all of those communications and the powers of attorney were prepared before the attorney had ever met with the friend. So the kinds of things that we see in the file, accurate and honest memorandum and correspondence, those make a difference. The knowledge that you've asked in of information in a way that information was reliably provided. The reasons between the reasons for the disinheritance. One thing that we find is inconsistencies between billing records, calendar events, file memos, phone records, and estate planning documents. Those are the kinds of things that attorneys need to understand to be able to handle their obligations. I believe under the question, if you believe your client is diminished, under the questions of Rule 1.14.
Well, we've got some more issues on in this area, and I know Tom has some additional ethics points he wants to make. Then I will talk about just a kind of a pure discussion of confidentiality rules in connection with this area. And then last, Adam and Tom will discuss joint representations in this area. But Tom, why don't you take it from here?
Sure, you bet. I don't really walk the walk as much as Adam does, but let me just give you kind of an ethical guideline from the ABA model rules, which most states, if not all states, have followed in this area, which is 1.14, the one that Adam and Bill mentioned. And that gives guidance to lawyers who are representing clients whose capacity might be diminished. And I don't know what lawyers did before then, frankly. I never dealt with this before. There was a 1.14 of the ABA model rules and the state parallels, but it must have been a nightmare trying to deal with it. And 1.14 does a really good job of kind of threading the needle. It basically says this: when the lawyer reasonably believes that the client has diminished capacity, is at risk of substantial, I'll come back and explore all these, physical, financial, or other harm, unless action is taken and cannot adequately act in the client's own interest, the lawyer may take reasonably necessary protective action, including consulting with individuals or entities that have the ability to take action to protect the client, and in appropriate cases, seeking the appointment of a guardian ad litem, conservator, or guardian. And a combination of that plus a 1996 legal ethics opinion from the ABA really give you very good guidance. It doesn't make it easy, but it sure gives you some a roadmap here. First, the ABA has said in its legal ethics opinion that the clients could face diminished capacity for a variety of reasons. They could be minority status. They could, in other words, you could be young. There could be mental impairment. There could be a spectrum of capacity problems. That's one of the reasons that in 2000 2002, the ABA changed the name of the rule from client under a disability to clients acting with diminished capacity. It's not just a light switch, yes or no. It's a spectrum. The first guidance that you get from the ABA is that you must maintain a normal attorney-client relationship as far as reasonably possible. In other words, you have to try your best to maintain a relationship. Interestingly, the ABA, in its ethics opinion, said that you can pointed to the other rule, 1.16 in the ABA ethics rules, that you can only withdraw if there's no material adverse effect on the interest of the client, and then there's a number of other exceptions. So the ABA's discussion seems to indicate that even if you might be uncomfortable in sort of acting, you almost have to act unless you withdraw. And it may be difficult to withdraw because there might be a material adverse effect if you withdraw and leaving the client in the clutches of the sort of people Adam was just describing. Okay, second, the lawyers are free to take reasonably necessary protective action if there's a risk of substantial physical, financial, or other harm. And that does not mean there's a, you think that the client, your impaired client, is kind of making bad decisions, that you would do something else. You would not invest in that real estate because you think it might only bring a 2% instead of a 6% return. There's got to be substantial problems here, substantial harm. And not just something that you disagree with. That's true of all clients, but that unfortunately makes it a little bit harder to draw that line of when you kind of intervene, but you don't intervene too quickly. Third, and this is pretty important, and Bill will spend quite a bit of time in the next segment on confidentiality, the lawyer, and I mentioned this before, representing someone who thinks the lawyer thinks might be impaired, may consult with individuals or entities that have the ability to take action to protect the client. And that is considered impliedly authorized under the ABA model rules to reveal client confidences. It says that you can basically go to the doctor if your client's a doctor and kind of talk to the doctor. Normally, you couldn't go to a doctor and ask to sort of describe to the doctor, this is what my client's doing. That would be a client confidence. And family members, too. So it's not quite as explicit as some of the things Bill will talk about in a minute, but there's almost an implied exception to the confidentiality rule if you're trying to look out for a client who might be slipping into some kind of impairment. Fourth, the lawyer can even seek the appointment of a guardian ad litem, a conservator, or a guardian under the rule. And that's interesting because it says you obviously must, quote, advocate the least restrictive action on behalf of the client. And so you don't automatically go to a guardian. I read a case recently, I don't think it's a recent case, but I read it recently where a lawyer had a guardian appointed when the client tried to fire the lawyer. So the court sort of made short shrift of that and said, no, you don't get to do that. The client isn't automatically crazy because she tried to fire you. So it's sort of a last resort. Although here at McGuire Woods in the Tyson's Corner office in Northern Virginia where I practice, several years ago, we did have to get a guardian appointed for an elderly client. There was a daughter who was pushing for it. It was one of those awkward things that Adam deals with every day. And so we had to go to court and seek the appointment of a guardian, and we were successful doing that over the client's objection, which is totally counterintuitive to lawyers. Normally, you take the client's direction. But the ABA model rule comment, 1.14, comment 8, says that you are impliedly authorized to make the disclosures that you need to and to seek the appointment of a guardian, quote, even when the client directs the lawyer to the contrary, close quote. Now, it's also totally counterintuitive, and we dealt with this here, is that you can't represent a third party in doing that. In our case, the daughter came to us and said, oh, my gosh, my mom's slipping. Can you represent me in seeking a guardian for her? And the answer is no, we can't, because then we have a conflict. We represented both of them, and we could not represent one client against another. But we did say this, we can represent your mother, not you. We can represent your mother in seeking the appointment of her guardian over her objection. So it may be kind of a fiction, but it's an important fiction that you are still representing the impaired client, and you can't represent another client in seeking a guardian to be appointed. And then fifth is sort of the crisis situation. Probably doesn't happen much. I hope it doesn't. But a comment to 1.14 deals with situations in which the client is threatened with imminent and irreparable harm if there is no immediate action taken, and the client cannot make considered judgment about the matter. This is only in an extraordinary situation, and the example given by the ABA ethics opinion, which is 404, in case you want to read it, gives the example of a lawyer whose client is about to be evicted. And that the lawyer and the ABA model, the ABA opinion says that the lawyer in that case could, quote, take action on behalf of the client to forestall or prevent the eviction. And then, probably to the disappointment of many lawyers, a comment to 1.14 says that the lawyer normally, quote, would not seek compensation, close quote, for the work in that extraordinary situation. That's only if the client's going to give away all his money to some Nigerian general or something like that. Then you can intervene in that case, but that's always the last resort. Maybe that's the last resort. Seeking the guardian is the second to last resort. But the bottom line here is that lawyers, even if you don't want to, you kind of have to deal with it, and you face all the problems that Adam discussed of having to do a good job if your client's starting to slip. And it's very difficult. I was saying before the meeting, my 94-year-old mother-in-law just died on Friday the 13th of December, and she was slipping near the end, and deciding when to intervene and take over bank accounts is just a horribly painful situation. And so none of us like to deal with it. Lawyers like to deal with it least of all, but you may not be able to avoid it under 1.14, and at least you have some place to turn for some guidance. So, Bill, let me turn it over to you now.
Okay. Thanks, Tom. I'd like to spend a few minutes dealing with the concept of confidentiality, particularly under the ethics rules, in this connection. Now, there are several things that I would like for the audience to know about. One is there's an organization, and some of you know about it, some of you belong to it, called the American College of Trust and Estate Counsel, and the acronym for that is ACTEC. And if you go to www.actec.org, you'll find a link to the ACTEC commentaries to the Model Rules of Professional Conduct. And that is a very, very helpful document. The way to find it is to go to the ACTEC website, and then in the lower right-hand corner, under other publications, is a reference to commentaries. And that's what these are, the ACTEC commentaries to the Model Rules. And, of course, trust and state lawyers are involved, as is Adam, all the time with these particular rules. And they do have a special reference to estate planning and also to impaired persons who are involved. So never lose sight of that. And the other thing I'm going to spend some time on is Model Rule 1.6. Every state has a version of Model Rule 1.6. One prominent exception is California. California doesn't have a rule of professional conduct on confidentiality, but they do have a statute. And it's California Business and Professions Code, Section 6068E, small e. And it for many, many years, has been an extremely strict lip sealer, so to speak, of lawyers for clients. There's almost nothing a lawyer could say about a client that wouldn't be a violation of that statute. And California lawyers are quite concerned about that. Now, several years ago, they did engraft an amendment. It's 6068E2, providing for the lawyer being able to disclose where the client is going to be involved in some sort of injuring someone physically, bodily injury. California does now in the statute recognize an exception for that. Now, we'll talk in a moment about Model Rule 1.6 and the various states that have adopted it and their exceptions to the duty of confidentiality. One of the things I'd like to emphasize is that the duty of confidentiality we're talking about here under the ethics rules is not the same as the attorney-client privilege. A lot of lawyers kind of carelessly confuse the two concepts and will say, well, that's privileged. Well, what they really mean is the lawyer is obligated not to reveal it because of an ethical rule, not because of some court rule. Tom, there was reference earlier to Tom's treatise on attorney-client privilege and work product. It's a two-volume work, and it's just absolutely excellent. The most recent iteration was published late last year. And in that book, under Section 2.2, is a discussion of the difference between the ethical duty of confidentiality and the attorney-client privilege. And now, any treatise on the privilege ought to have such a discussion. I don't happen to know whether it's in the other sources or not. But in any event, there is a difference, and as you get into this, you need to know it. One other thing I meant to mention earlier is when you talk about the duty of confidentiality and an impaired person, whether it be a client or somebody else, it's really the rules on confidentiality are awfully complex. And as a friend of mine, Lucian Pera in Memphis, would say, don't try this at home. If you think you are near a situation where your client is being abused, an impaired client being abused, or whether you think your client is the abuser, you have very serious issues to think about in terms of what you can say and to whom about that. And the average good lawyer and the average estate planning lawyer is probably not capable of doing a thorough analysis of this on his or her own, and you need help when you get into this area. But let's talk about Rule 1.6 for a moment. That's the rule of confidentiality. And for many, many years, the ethics rules referred to the duty of a lawyer not to reveal, quote, confidences and secrets, end of quote, of the client. That was changed in 1983 when the model rules were adopted by the ABA in the form of Rule 1.6. And 1.6 in the model rule dropped confidences and secrets, and now it says information relating to the representation. Now, that in the minds of many is a big difference. What that means is it isn't just what the client tells you that you can't reveal to other people or what information you got from the client. Anything relating to the representation of the client is covered by Rule 1.6, and you shouldn't go around revealing it. That's the lip-sealing rule, information relating to the representation of a client. Now, a number of states, when they adopted Rule 1.6, kept the confidences and secrets rubric, or the terminology, and other states adopted the new language, information relating to the representation. That is the sort of thing an expert would refer to when they're assisting you in navigating your way through one of these difficult impaired client situations. Now, 1.6, the model rule 1.6, has a number of exceptions, and the two that we're most concerned with here today are B1 and B2, and it's worth reading to you. I hate to do this, but because it can be quite boring, but 1.6B says a lawyer may, notice I said may, reveal information relating to the representation of a client to the extent the lawyer reasonably believes necessary, and here are the two exceptions. One, to prevent reasonably certain death or substantial bodily harm. So that's the physical harm exception. Two, to prevent the client from committing a crime or fraud that is reasonably certain to result in substantial injury to the financial interests or property of another, and in furtherance of which the client is used or is using the lawyer's services. Now, those exceptions really apply to when your client is the abuser. Those are the things you should refer to. And don't forget, the California statute now has an exception for a client physically harming someone else. It doesn't have a financial harm exception, but it does have physical harm. Now, it's absolutely essential that you do a careful analysis in order to apply confidentiality rules to your practice. You need to know who in the world you represent. Now, I've come up with three possibilities. The first is you're representing an impaired person, or you're representing a person who it may be on the cusp of needing a guardian or a conservator or something of that nature, but doesn't yet have it. And you're somewhat unsure, and his or her relatives are somewhat unsure as to whether or not you need the appointment of someone like that. Well, you need to be concerned. For example, I would normally say if somebody was if you represent that person and someone was either physically harming that person or about to harm that person or taking money from that person, that there's no ethics rule preventing you from telling on whoever's doing the abusing, because you don't represent the abuser, you represent the person being harmed. But you got to be careful there too, because it may well be, let's say it's a favorite nephew of the person, and the person knows the nephew is taking some of his or her money, but that's okay. That's information relating to the representation, and it might not come within the exception, and the abused person may not want you to talk about it. Now, notice, these are very fine distinctions, and they're very difficult, and that's why I say don't try this at home. Now, that's where you represent the impaired person without a guardian or a conservator or a trustee. Let's talk about now where you represent the guardian or the trustee, the fiduciary, for an impaired person who has been declared to be impaired, or whatever the current word. What is it now, Adam? Is it incompetent? Is that the word, the standard?
Incompetency would be the question of the ability to make decisions, and it relates to guardianship.
Okay. So in any event, so that person clearly has been adjudicated that, and now there is a guardian or a trustee or a fiduciary, and you're representing that person. I think still, if the impaired person is being abused, either financially or physically, there's no prohibition for you to take action and to tell whoever you need to tell about it in order for it to stop. Now, let's get to the most difficult area, is where you happen to be representing somebody who you think might be abusing an impaired person. Either physically, you've heard stories, you've seen bruises, or something of that nature, or the abused person's bank account seems to be short somehow, that you happen to know that, and you have a suspicion that your client is the one who's responsible for that. You don't know it for sure yet. That's where, again, you need help to analyze where you stand in terms of what you can tell and who you can tell about it. So, again, it's rule. This is issue spotting now. I cannot give you precise guidelines on how you have to conduct yourself when you suspect there's being this sort of either physical or financial abuse. There's one other ethics rule I mentioned just briefly, and it's rule 8.4C, and if I can quickly get my hands on it here, I'm going to read that one to you, because it's sort of a catch-all. And when you think about people, a lawyer involved in the abuse or assisting in the abuse of someone, you think of this language. 8.4C says it is professional misconduct for a lawyer to C, engage in conduct involving dishonesty, fraud, deceit, or misrepresentation. That's pretty broad. And it would be rare, I would think, that where a lawyer were involved in this sort of abuse, not to be guilty of Rule 8.4C. I'm going to stop there unless somebody has a question on confidentiality. I mean, there will be a question time at the end for the audience. And turn it over to Adam and Tom. You guys have agreed on how to split this up, I think, on joint representations and related issues.
Great. Before we start on that, I do have a question about the confidentiality that I wanted to address with you and get your thoughts. I think 42 states have mandatory reporting statutes with regard to elder abuse, which has been defined in states to include financial exploitation and or physical abuse.
I'm glad you mentioned that because I did not know that.
In Ohio, because I've looked at this and I've worked with the Adult Protective Services groups in Ohio on their belief as to whether attorneys are mandatory reporters. The statute itself is not explicit on the subject, but it refers to professionals who represent or deal with the elderly, which could include bankers, physicians, and likely as well lawyers.
Yeah, Tom, I've been reading cases on confidentiality for years, and I don't recall a clash between a lawyer's duty under 1.6 to maintain confidences and these mandatory reporting laws. Does either of you, have you seen that?
I know that Oregon has a statute that specifically says lawyers have a duty to report child abuse. But I think in most states, my understanding is that we are not bound to report child abuse if our client has committed it in the past, for instance. If somebody hires you who is an accused child abuser and you come to know the child abuse that has occurred, it would be totally inconsistent with our duties as lawyers to then blow the whistle on our own client for something that's already happened. So I'm not sure the clash ever comes to light, because it seems obvious that even accused child abusers who may be guilty are entitled to a lawyer. And so I think if you're representing the accuser, the accused, or actually the abuser, I guess the accused or the actual abuser, that the normal confidentiality duties would apply. And I don't think many states have specifically listed lawyers. It sounds, Adam, like Ohio hasn't listed lawyers specifically either, so I bet it doesn't trump the lawyer's duties.
That's an interesting question. Why don't we move into the joint representation? Who wants to lead off on that?
Well, yeah, let me, with the way this, Adam and I split this up, is I'm going to kind of give again the 10,000-foot level, and Adam's going to jump in with examples in his real life, which sounds much more interesting than my practice, Bill, I don't know about yours.
I agree.
But, as Adam and Bill and I talked about, I like to, with a few litigations I've had involving estate fights and stuff, is always interesting because it makes my family seem more functional than I always think it is. But anyway, the question here is joint representations, and that has both privilege implications big time in the estate planning context and ethics implications, and even in the estate administration context as well, and when there's possible abuse, for sure. On the privilege world, let me just take a minute there. Outsiders destroy the privilege. If you share things with an outsider, you waive it. If an outsider is sitting there during a privilege conversation, there's no privilege that applies. In some cases, it's easy to determine this, easy in the conceptual sense, difficult in the real world sense. For instance, if a financial planner comes with an estate planning client to the lawyer has to basically kick out the financial planner from the meeting, even though the financial planner is the one that brought the client, because he or she is an outsider. Much more difficult with relatives, because if an outsider is necessary, like a translator or an interpreter, those people are inside the privilege. And so Adams has probably, you probably litigated cases like this. I read a Florida case last year where a 70-year-old woman had her daughter with her when they were talking to their estate planning lawyer, and the court needed more facts. Said, I want to know, whether the woman was sick, whether she really needed her daughter there. If I were to have my daughter in a meeting with a lawyer of mine, that would clearly blow the privilege. So joint representation cinches the privilege. If you have two clients, you can clearly talk to both of them, but it may create ethics issues, conflict issues. It's always critical to identify the client. It always amazes me how lawyers often don't really think of that. There's what we call representation creep, what some have done. It happens in my corporate world. As a litigator, I see it when somebody begins to represent the patriarch of a family, and then you've got the son gets into his own business, and the daughter starts a business and you kind of represent them, and then you're doing the patriarch's will, and then there's a wholly owned company that brings some other shareholders in, you start to do their work. If you don't know who your client is every minute of every day, you are going to really be in trouble. And the times that McGuire Woods has gotten in trouble in some of the liability world is when it hasn't been clear. So always know who your client is, and it's not easy to identify. Retainer letter's great, but half the time you begin to the daughter brings the mom in, and you begin to do work for the daughter too, and you never really kind of clean up the paperwork. So determining if there is a joint representation, that is, you got two clients to whom you have equal duty of loyalty, is a legal issue. It's not really an ethics issue. You look at who pays the bills, but that's not dispositive, what the communications are. If there's no retainer letter, you got to look at all sorts of factors. And it's often difficult to determine if it's a joint representation. But, boy, does it have ramifications if it is a joint representation. And Adam, I'm a fast talker, so jump in anytime you want. There's loyalty issues and there's information flow issues. The loyalty issues are easier to address in some way. You can't represent, two siblings, two sisters of an estate planning client if they're at each other's throats all the time and they have very different ideas about what to do with their mom, for instance, or their dad. So you look at the beginning. The obvious one is that you can't represent two clients jointly if one is a claim against the other. That's obvious, and you can never pursue a claim by one against the other. That's the one everybody knows. The harder one is this. You can't have a representation if, and I'm reading from ABA Model Rule 1.7, if there's a significant risk that the representation of one or more clients will be materially limited by the lawyer's responsibilities to another client, a former client or a third person, or by a personal interest of the lawyer. That's much more difficult. Folks have called that a rheostat conflict because it means that once it's not automatic like the adversity one. It means that once you begin to have your judgment affected by your duty of loyalty to somebody else, then you got a real problem. If it's and that's not just a joint representation, but in any representation, we've had this situation in the estate planning world than in Adam's world of estate litigation afterwards, where a father. Kind of drags his 30-year-old daughter in and doesn't like the woman, doesn't like the guy that she married, and says, my daughter's here to do an estate plan, and I've got an idea of what it should be. I want to keep that out of that SOB's hands, so I want you to represent me and my daughter. Well, boy, we can't do that for obvious reasons. There's no claim against each other, but we're clearly, our judgment's going to be materially limited. We can only represent one or the other in that situation. So you first have to determine on the loyalty issue, the loyalty side of the analysis, whether you're going to be able to jointly represent more than one family member. And of course, you can have privileged conversations with the agent of the estate planning client if it's really necessary. A very elderly woman who still has the capacity to do things, according as Adam described the standard, but who just wants her daughter there because she's sort of, the mom's kind of feeble, and the daughter helps her understand things. Maybe the mom's not a native English speaker, for instance, classic example. So you don't need to represent the daughter, then the daughter is kind of the agent. But if you represent the daughter, bingo, you've got that duty of loyalty to her as well. And we had that issue, as I said, in McGuire Woods, when we represented clearly by retainer the daughter and the mom needed a guardian. That's the easy part, is loyalty. The information flow is the harder part, believe it or not, because if there's no description of the information flow, that is, if it's not clear in the retainer letter that there will be either no secrets, if one of you tells something, I'm telling the other, or occasionally you'll say, I'm going to keep secrets. If you tell me something, I'm not going to tell the other joint client. Absent that, it's a total hodgepodge. The ABA model rules are inconsistent. They seem to go in the direction of you got to keep secrets, even if it's a joint representation. Again, in the estate planning world, if the husband comes to you, you're doing the husband-wife's estate plan, and he says, no, my wife doesn't know it, but I fathered a young boy with my secretary, and I want to leave him a little bit of money. Do you tell the wife that, yes or no? The ABA model rules don't give you much guidance. And the restatement seems to be a no-secrets approach. The best way, the easiest way for lawyers to act, takes the burden off us, is to have an a no-secrets approach. That is, that's what most retainer letters do. They'll say, listen, joint clients, if one of you tells something that to me about this matter we're handling for both of you, I'm going to tell the other one. So don't tell me anything if you don't want me to share it. The ACTEC commentaries that Bill mentioned hold out some glimmer of hope. In the estate planning world, you can have a keep secrets approach. I don't know how you can possibly do that, but most of the time it should be a no secrets approach, and then that puts you a little bit at risk as a lawyer that you might get knocked out if one of them comes to you and says, well, you know, I want to tell you something, but I don't want you to tell my wife about it, or I don't. The daughter says, I got something to tell you, but you know, I don't want my mom to know, even though she's another client here. Then you're going to have to probably drop out. So you may not be able to continue the joint representation, but at least you won't have this agonizing decision about what to do with the information, especially if it's material and somebody would, the wife would want to know that the husband had fathered an illegitimate child, that sort of thing. So Adam, let me turn over to you if you have any thoughts about that, and you probably have actually seen it in the real world.
I have, and it's always fascinating. And from the litigation perspective in an estate matter, it affects the credibility of the lawyer and makes it more difficult to uphold an instrument. Makes it easier for me if I'm pursuing a challenge to set the instrument aside if that's what we're dealing with. You know, with the 1.14 rule, the lawyer may take reasonable necessary protection action, including consulting with individuals or entities. I take that to mean that if mom wants her daughter in the room, that's something that I can consider doing if it's going to aid in the representation. From the standpoint of conflicts, I mean, there's a case in Ohio. It's a case where a lawyer wrote a will that benefited himself. And in the process of considering the issue and determining that that was not allowed in Ohio, it was presumptively undue influence, a disinterested attorney, the court said, could be expected to pick up cues, even fairly subtle cues, that his client intentions may have changed since the will was executed, and by that representation and the benefit obtained by the lawyer in that circumstance, which would, I think, apply similarly to a client, would give rise to that conflict issue. The interesting case, one of the interesting cases I had was a mother had purportedly executed a trust instrument that cut out one of her children. The lawyer that drafted the trust instrument had represented the father and one of the brothers who had a joint business that the attorney acquired a significant amount of his income from. And in cross-examining the attorney, after we found out that the will was, in essence, signed outside of his presence, and why he wrote a trust instrument that eliminated a child without meeting with the client, he said as follows. My recollection of the client was her husband was a strong-willed man. He pretty much made decisions in the family relative to money, business, and estate planning. And she, like many spouses, just kind of went along with whatever her husband indicated he wanted her to do. That was testimony relating to a trust amendment that significantly impaired the one child's right to inherit. And so we're dealing with a situation where the client was the husband and his and one of the sons, and the attorney didn't even take cues or speak with the person who was drafting the trust instrument. That's a clear failure to identify who the client is. It's a clear failure to identify a conflict, and it was a clear failure that caused the trust instrument to be set aside.
Guys, let's see. There's just a minute or two left. Let's see if there are any questions from the audience. Operator, please provide our listeners with instructions on what they need to do to ask questions.
Certainly. If you wish to ask a question, please press the star key on your touch tone phone, followed by the 1 key. That's star 1. When you do, you will be told your place in line. To get out of the queue, just press the pound sign. When prompted for your question, please be brief.
I've got a couple of questions. One is, Adam, when I used to handle cases against an insurance company involving suicide, and there was a manual called it something like the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual on something. Does that ring any bells with you?
Is that the diagnostic manual relating to this DSM-4?
Yeah.
The psychiatric manual?
Yes. Is elder abuse covered there specifically?
Well, the psychiatrist that I've talked to about these issues, there is no diagnosis, as far as I know, of elder abuse, though the geriatric community is working on creating models as to how to deal with it. And so it's a growing field, and it's of growing interest to geriatricians and to psychiatrists and to people who treat the elder community, which statute I think is 60 and up or 65 and up, depending on the various states.
Okay. Operator, are there any questions?
There are currently no phone questions.
Okay. Tom, briefly, you might mention the Martha Stewart case. I think you and I have talked about that, where she confided in her daughter what was going on in the grand jury.
Yeah, it was a good example of just how fragile the privilege is. Martha Stewart.
The court said that the privilege didn't work, but that work product did work.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, she wrote an email to her lawyer describing what she recalled of the sale of the stock, Amazon stock, and gave it to her daughter the next day, the email that she sent to her law firm. And it was considered to waive the privilege but not the work product doctrine, which is a good one. I just read an interesting case. It's not a recent case, but it comes from Connecticut, where a plaintiff's lawyer is setting up a video of his dying plaintiff, a personal injury plaintiff dying of asbestos or asbestosis or something. The videographer is kind of working around the room, and they do the videotape, the dying declaration of the client who then dies. And the question is, can the defendant depose the videographer? And the court says, yeah, you bet. He wasn't necessary for the communication. He was just doing his thing. And you might say, well, wait a minute. Did they waive work product? What about the work product protection? And the Connecticut court said, no, work product only protects documents and tangible things. That's what the rule says. So in that case, the oral communication was not protected. And you can imagine, I mean, we all talk as people bring in lunch into the conference rooms and your firm, Adam, and all the rest of it. And so theoretically, we're putting stuff at risk.
Okay. Operator, any other questions?
There are currently no phone questions.
Okay, then let's wrap it up. That's all the time we've got today. If you were not able to ask your question or one occurs to you later, our contact information has been provided on your written material. I'm Bill Freivogel. On behalf of Tom Spahn, Adam Fried, and myself, thank you for joining us today.
On behalf of the Professional Education Broadcast Network, thank you for listening. This concludes today's teleseminar.